Korean state officials attended the ceremony to honor his lofty status and unique role in the missile program of the country.
Martyr Tehrani Muqaddam opened the chapter of self-reliance in the defense industry and put an end to the thoughts of unwilling people who said we don't have the strength to compete in any industry. He believed that we can and thus became the father of Iran's missile program.
Tehrani Muqaddam, a commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, was a key figure in Iran's ballistic missile program. An engineer by profession, he designed the Shahab, Qadr, and Sajil missiles with a range of over 1,000 kilometers. Tehrani Muqaddam began establishing Iran's missile program when the country was under attack during the eight-year Iraqi post-war on Iran. He continued his efforts to boost the program in subsequent years amid difficulties and shortages.
Today, we're at the peak of military power, and we have prepared ourselves for all situations. Today, we're not only at the world level in the field of missiles, but also in drones, space, defense, radar, and other sectors. For such achievements, we have used the model of Shahid Tehrani Muqaddam.
Tehrani Muqaddam was martyred in an explosion in November 2011. The blast came during a missile test at a base in Bidgane, west of Tehran. At least 16 others were also killed in the blast.
Observers say the West's efforts to stop Iran's missile program over the past couple of years reveals the significance of Tehrani Muqaddam's legacy, which serves as Iran's main power of deterrence. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
After 5 weeks of shocking war crimes, official Western pressure is finally mounting on Tel Aviv. French President Emmanuel Macron admitted in an interview that Israel's actions have, quote, no legitimacy. He added, quote, these babies, these ladies, these old people are bombed and killed, so there is no reason for that. So we do urge Israel to stop. Citizen pressure on Tel Aviv continues with marches worldwide, with over 10,000 marching across Paris.
Macron has to finally extend actual support to the Palestinians and force Israel to accept a ceasefire. This is an attempt at genocide, and there are children dying every day.
The deliberate targeting of civilians has left over 11,000 Palestinians murdered, which is more dead civilians in 1 month than in over 1.5 years of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. Many say that Israel's 75-year-long brutality, repression, and human rights violations are out in the open like never before, and that things will never be the same.
Global opinion has changed because all these videos on Twitter and Instagram make it crystal clear who the aggressor is. And the double standard with Ukraine is also obvious. The French government constantly cried that this was a scandal, but then they remained silent as Gazans die day and night.
Israel has increased their bombing and murder in Lebanon, further sparking the possibility of a major multinational war.
As Lebanese, firstly, we're concerned by the crisis that's happening in Gaza, because Lebanon was previously occupied by Israel. In 1982, Beirut was the second Arab capital occupied by Israel. And so we've had the bitter taste of occupation before by the Israelis. Currently, south of Lebanon is under attack by Israel. This conflict can turn into a regional conflict with Hezbollah getting involved, Israel instigating Lebanese parties, the Syrians, the Iranians, the Yemenis into this conflict.
This week, at the first Western-hosted summit on Palestine, Macron said the clear conclusion was that, quote, there is no other solution than a humanitarian pause and then going on to a ceasefire, end quote. Marchers here hope that Washington and Tel Aviv listen to the sound of the global chorus. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Tens of thousands of people have marched through the streets of Cape Town to the office of the provincial administration. They have called on the South African government to support the oppressed Palestinians. The government has downgraded ties with Israel, but protesters want a complete severing of relations.
The West continuously put the narrative through Hamas terrorist group. Hamas is a resistance group for the liberation. In South Africa, when we fought against the apartheid regime, we were called liberators. We were supported when we fought against the apartheid regime. When they do it, when Hamas do it, they call them terrorists.
The march was organized by a broad coalition of organizations, including religious bodies, Jewish groups, political parties, including the ruling ANC, and trade unions. South Africa's government has withdrawn its diplomatic staff from Tel Aviv, but it still plays host to the Israeli ambassador, something people here are not happy with.
This has been described as the mother of all marches. It is probably the biggest demonstration that South Africa has hosted since the outbreak of the latest violence in occupied Palestine. Protesters say they will continue to come out onto the streets until the South African government takes decisive steps to expel the Israeli ambassador.
People must pressure government into action at times. This is but one of those pressures. Cape Townians have shown that they are with the people of Palestine. Their government must take another step further. The government of the ANC must do that.
But even with the inaction of politicians, and while South Africa's Christian party, the ACDP, standing fully behind Israel, increasingly those who follow the faith are seeing for themselves how the Bible is being abused.
The God that I pray to would never condone what is going on in Palestine, and that's why we're here today, to show our support. How do you feel as a
Christian? This was the reaction of these women when I asked about the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's use of biblical scripture to justify the massacres.
I think when it comes to the Bible, I mean, we live by our teachings, but it can be, anyone can take the Bible and twist what God's word says into what they want it to mean. And I think that's exactly what's happening with Netanyahu. I mean, he's basically doing what he wants and trying to justify it by twisting what the scriptures say.
The protests are growing bigger and more diverse. For every Palestinian the American-backed Israeli war machine kills, another voice rises against it. Hassan Sirip, Cape Town.
In a passionate display of unity, people from diverse backgrounds gathered at the rally in a powerful show of solidarity with Palestine. The crowd, carrying Palestinian flags and banners, voiced their condemnation of the actions taken by Israel and the United States, demanding justice and equality for the people of Palestine.
The percentage of children who have died in this conflict is more than that who have died in 2 years of Ukraine conflict. It itself shows that actually it's not a war, it's a genocide going on. They are intentionally killing civilians, they are intentionally killing children. 30% or more are actually women.
Speakers at the rally passionately articulated the need for a peaceful resolution to the long-standing conflict and called for an end to the oppression faced by the Palestinian people.
1400 years ago, what happened in Karbala, you are repeating that. My message to Israel is, stop being a genocide, be a human, face the reality. My question is to the United Nations, if it happens somewhere in Europe, how would they react?
Participants expressed their commitment to raising awareness about the plight of Palestinians, highlighting the urgency of finding a just and lasting solution to the conflict.
We cannot turn a blind eye to the relentless oppression unfolding in Palestine. We must bear witness to the suffering of the Palestinian people, who face not just physical, but emotional and psychological scars.
Similar rallies were held in various cities of the country with a sense of determination and hope as participants pledged to continue their advocacy for the rights of the Palestinian people.
Expressions of solidarity with the oppressed Palestinians during these rallies not only signify a rejection of Israel's atrocities, but also serve as a platform for Pakistanis to voice their discontent with the international community's response to the crisis in Gaza. Nasik Azmi, Press TV, Islamabad.
The organizers said it was going to be big, and they were right. Hundreds of thousands of people showing solidarity with Palestine. and united in one thing.
A ceasefire. Stop the genocide, because that's what's happening. We can all see it.
We need to speak up. The world needs to wake up and speak up. This is not okay. This is genocide, and not in our name. That's why we're here today. Not in our name.
It's the biggest march since the Israeli onslaught on Gaza commenced, with hundreds of thousands of people walking hours to the American Embassy in London to condemn U.S. support for the Israeli regime. The protest was organized by Palestinian support groups, Muslim organizations, and peace movements. People of all faiths and no faith, some all the way from Northern Ireland, angry with decades of Israel's brutal military occupation in the occupied territories. Anger at the British government, too, for cracking down on these demonstrations, describing them as hate marches and pro-Palestine mobs.
In the run-up to today's march, the UK's right-wing interior minister, Sueli Braverman, tried to get the police to cancel it because it coincides with Armistice Day, commemorating the end of the First World War, a move campaigners and organizers have described as a crackdown on freedom of speech.
Previously, she asked police to make a call on whether even waving a Palestinian flag constituted a racially aggravated offense. Today, as in previous rallies, a forest of Palestinian flags. More than anything, today's march, which harks back to the mass demonstration before the 2003 U.S.-led illegal invasion of Iraq, is aimed at pushing the British state, which during the First World War publicly promised a national home for the Jewish people in its controversial 1917 Balfour Declaration, to pressure Israel to cease its brutal shelling of Gaza. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The Supreme Follow-up Committee of the Palestinian Revolutionary Factions organized a major protest in Yarmouk camp on Friday to support the resistance and condemn the massacre committed by the Israeli regime against defenseless civilians in Gaza.
We assure our people in Gaza that we stand with them resiliently, sharing their wounds and pain. We tell the occupying entity that we will liberate Al-Aqsa Mosque and meet our people in Palestine. We pledge to the resistance front to pray in Al-Quds.
The defeated Israeli occupation is taking revenge by killing children and women and historically destroying humanity.
We, the Islamic Jihad Al-Quds Brigades abroad, vow to enter Palestine and liberate it, as we promise to eliminate Israel.
With unbridled fury, demonstrators burned the Israeli flag, confirming that the resilient resistance front has proven that American threats no longer intimidate anyone, and vowed to defend Palestine with their lives until liberation.
As the Palestinian resistance and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah have stated, let America come. So we will fight our main and fundamental enemy. We are not afraid of America's intimidations, as it is more cowardly than waging a war.
We call on everyone and every country capable of doing anything to imagine their children thirsty, dismembered, lying in a hospital or buried under rubble.
Protesters called on international community to assume its human responsibility by ending the brutal Israeli aggression on Gaza and lifting the siege imposed on its people.
Syrians and Palestinians gathered today to tell the world that Palestine is a beacon that will never fade, and the people of Gaza will never capitulate despite the tremendous Western support for the Israeli atrocities committed against them. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
As the death toll mounts on day 40 of the Israeli war in Gaza, the Israeli regime continues to target hospitals, in particular the Al-Shifa hospital, claiming that Hamas is using it as a command and control center and holds captives there. Hamas has repeatedly denied that and has asked the UN to visit the place and prove the falsehood of the claim. Israeli forces who raided the medical center today have not found anything to that effect. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the Israeli genocidal war, the U.S. support for the continuation of this war, and how Israel's goal is to impose another Nakba on the Palestinians. These are the guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Patrick Henningsen is a geopolitical analyst who joins us from Los Angeles. Also joining us is John Phoenix, journalist and international relations expert, who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. First, I will start with you, Patrick, if I may. And we are taking a look at Shifa Hospital, as you're well aware, that's being targeted by the regime forces. At this point, we understand that that has included murdering Palestinians. They've arrested some, not only patients, but also people who work there, like engineers. And at the same time, obviously, patients' lives are at risk because overall they wanted to evacuate the hospital. I'm not too sure if they're going to be able to do that. And this is all under the understanding that they think that the hospital is being used for military purposes by Hamas. No evidence of that. Nothing has been shown yet. What do you think about the fact that the hospital, which is being targeted by Israel, and that is something that is banned under international law?
Yeah, it is. It is pretty amazing. I mean, we've seen the systematic targeting of medical facilities, multiple hospitals. In fact, in total, you could say 16 hospitals have been targeted, have been disabled, or in some cases destroyed by the Israeli occupation forces, along with at least 30 other primary care facilities, multiple shelters as well, including UN shelters. So one has to ask why this policy of targeting hospitals specifically. There seems to be some sort of objective here. And one can only say that aside from the propaganda value of being able to claim that that Hamas is somehow has these secret bases under all these hospitals, or they're hiding entrances to tunnels or weapons caches. We've heard just about everything. The only thing we haven't heard yet is that they're hiding weapons of mass destruction under one of these hospitals. And don't be surprised if that comes out from the IDF in the next couple of days. Who knows? But the sort of the PR performative skits that we've seen are kind of really an act of desperation, because I think what they're trying to do, the Israelis, is to vindicate this bombing campaign against these civilian areas in northern Gaza, somehow to vindicate all this, to justify it by finding, quote, evidence that it was all worth it because we found this Hamas command and control center, supposedly. And there is no receipts for this. They've been not able to come up with any real evidence other than these sort of ham-fisted attempts by members of the IDF or spokespeople saying that this is how we found this evidence and we've got this here, and then now we're providing aid, so we're actually helping the people in Al-Shifa Hospital. I mean, and it's ridiculous in the extreme.
All right, the thing that you mentioned there about the aid, also we need to discuss the way that they think that they're providing aid. But John Phoenix, when you take a look at the credibility of Israel, we don't need to look that far back in terms of just days, where you have the claim on the Al-Rantisi Hospital, where you had the Israeli spokesperson for the army point to the, or maybe one of the Israeli regime forces pointing to a calendar that was hung on a wall that claimed to be a target list, if you recall that, and also the elevator shaft that was claimed to be a tunnel. So that is debunked. Now, that really puts Israel on a shaky footing, to say the least here. So how can that be backed by the U.S. And the U.S. to support that claim? Well, not this particular claim, but the claim that hospitals are being used as the for military purposes, or is the U.S. just taking whatever Israel is feeding it to be okay and for it to back it? What is your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, you don't need to go far. Let's just start from the allegation of that the 40 children, you know, where the Hamas chopped off 40 children. At that time, I don't think Biden seen anything. At that time, Biden claimed that he did see 40 children in a photo, which is shown to him by the Israelis. As you understand, the domestic policy in the state, the Zionist lobby is so strong enough to control, obviously, these puppets. They're repeating the Israeli lies. I mean, let's say, just go back to the beginning of your question about the tunnels. Well, let's assume for a few minutes that it was tunnels under Ashifa Hospital. Well, I don't understand why, if there is tunnels under hospital, what the justification of killing medical personnel? 202 nurses and doctors was killed in the 40 days, 36 civil defense, 53 ambulances been destroyed in the street, and 25 hospitals being destroyed. They were invited by a lot of international bodies to allow them to visit the hospitals as a witness and to try to visit the hospitals and see if there is any tunnels. And anyway, they enter the hospital early morning, and the hospitals are now being converted from a hospital to the detention camp, where the refugees who thought this is a safe haven for them, and nearly 50,000 people there. Some of the people were being killed in a yard outside the buildings. They cannot even be reached because the snipers, if you try to rescue anybody, the sniper will kill people who try to rescue them. Some of them for the last 4 days now dying from wind and starvation and hunger, you know. So anyway, they take over the hospital. They did not find anything under the hospital. Okay. Well, so what's the justification walking in and destroying the medical facilities and bombing the warehouse, which has got a few what left from the medicine and other machinery in the hospital? You know, it is a designed policy to destroy the health service, to punish the Palestinians as much as they can. So the question is now, what other lies they're going to come, obviously, with soon? The calendar you just mentioned, too, if you know more about the hospital, where they actually went in there, the Arabic verse, which it says, planning attack on the 8th of October, it was added, actually. You can see, if you look close, it was added, you know. They're not short of a lot of Zionists who can write Arabic anyway. The names of the individuals on that list, they are members of the hospitals. You can actually investigate that, because sure, these people are still alive, you know. So the problem is Zionists cannot really, they're not good liars. Every time they lie, they get exposed.
Sure.
That's a problem.
Well, yeah. you make a statement that Patrick Hennington, our guest, makes a statement there that based on what he said, then therefore he concludes that Israel just wants to punish Palestinians. Now, that is the question here. Why is Israel doing that? And one analyst has said that Israel commits war crimes by punishing Palestinians because this is not by design. It's actually by default. That is what it wants to do. Now, the question is, why has Israel pursued the genocidal war that it has in this particular war in the form and manner that it has? Previous wars, yes, disproportionate. Lots of Palestinians were murdered, but not to this degree.
Sure. Look, there's obviously a vendetta. There's obviously a vengeance motive, or at least that's how it's been framed, for the Israeli public, for the Israeli political body as well, for the West, that on October 7th, that Hamas carried out all these various alleged atrocities, beheaded babies, etc., mass rape, and all these things that there haven't been any real evidence produced to validate. That formed the narrative that justified this kind of overwhelming reaction by the Israeli occupation forces, this rapacious bombing campaign, suspension of all norms in terms of, you know, international law, Geneva Conventions, that all of that needs to be suspended because of the, quote, horrors of what happened to the Israeli settlers, et cetera, on October 7th, even though a lot of those have been systematically debunked, most of all by the Israeli press as well and eyewitnesses within Israel. So that's one reason. It's like kind of weapons-free, you know, the gloves are off, we're going to go in with maximum force, and we don't care who dies or gets in the way. It's all collateral damage and the, quote, war on terror. That's one side. Here's the other side. It's a political dimension. Benjamin Netanyahu and this government have basically gotten elected on this idea that they're the security administration, that Netanyahu is the security prime minister, that he and only he can guarantee the security of Israeli settlers in all of these dubious locations in the occupied territories. And that's part of the whole sales pitch of modern Israel, that they are safe. This one place in the world where Jewish people can come from around the world and the diaspora can return to their homeland and be safe. Well, obviously, it's the most least safe place in the world. So if he's not the security prime minister, and if this is not the security administration, they cannot go back to their voters or their support base and claim they are, because all that was shattered on October 7th. So what are they? they have to double down. So instead of being the security prime minister or the security administration, they have to become the genocide prime minister and the genocide government administration. And this is a very popular sales line to a lot of the hard line in Israel, is we need to get rid of them. We need to exterminate them. We need to make life so miserable and so unlivable that they'll have no choice but to flee to the south of Gaza, and then maybe, if we're lucky, to the Sinai Desert, where they can live in tent cities. This is what Israeli officials are saying publicly and have been saying, and not just Israeli,
sure,
but also officials in the United States as well, and other countries supporting Israel. So it's almost like they've backed themselves into a corner on this hard line, that there's no other way other than to execute a sort of final solution, if you will, for what they call the Palestinian problem in their, what they believe is all the greater Israel area. So this is the problem, and I think this is what you're seeing here, doubling down and really going from bad to worse, throwing bad money after bad money. This is what Israel's strategy. Unfortunately, they don't have any other strategy other than sort of to back off and admit they made a huge mistake here. That's not going to happen.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, let's look at what John Phoenix said there, Patrick Hennington, about Israeli officials and what they feel about Palestinians, basically amounting for them to be uprooted. The Extreme Minister Smotrich said voluntary migration of Palestinians in Gaza is the right humanitarian solution. You have Danny Danon, who is a former ambassador to the UN. He has made also in an editorial or a commentary in the Wall Street Journal suggesting moving some people of Gaza to nations that will accept them. And also, the most recent, the former director of Israel's spy agency, Shin Bet, he said that Tel Aviv was rolling out a Nakba in the Gaza Strip. This is what Netanyahu wanted to do from the onset, and now we're seeing that come out, even though Netanyahu told this former director of Shin Bet that he shouldn't have said that. But that appears to be obviously what Israel wants to do. Do you think that, do you agree with that? And do you think they're going to go through with this or not? John Phoenix.
Yes. So, well, just remind our listeners that it was a plan actually come to light, obviously, that the Israeli Secret Service had a plan where the Palestinians should be all driven to Sinai. Was actually talk about that before the genocide, the slaughter of the Palestinians between the United States and Egypt and Israel. So it's not a surprise, the intense killing of the Palestinians is to drive them, as Patrick said, to drive them to the south, and in the south will be obviously people entrapped, no food, no medicine, no gas, no light. And bombing, as you see now, the bombing is still on the south. They're asking people to move from the north. And when they move, they bomb them in a way. And if they arrive there, they bomb them in the south. If you look at the last week, most of the bombing in Khan Yunis, Rafah, which is bordering Egypt, they intend to do that to force the Palestinians to force themselves to the Egyptian side, where they, after they enter the Egypt, you block the border, and that's it, you are out of Gaza. That's the whole idea, is to push the Palestinians. And this was a plan actually revealed by the Israeli media. It's just actually before the attack, this plan was there. You know, just also want to add something. Netanyahu, he's also on shaky ground. As you know, he was indicted for corruption. He's trying to survive as much as he can for his political life. And that's why he allied himself with this gang of fascists like him. In regard to Sternlich, he said that Palestinians should voluntarily move out of Gaza to outside Gaza. You know, that's the same man who, when the settlers attacked Hawara and West Bank and killed Palestinians and burned hundreds of cars and homes, he said, "Is no Hawara exist?" And he was forced to apologize after that. So that bunch of new Nazis sitting in the parliament deciding the fate of the Palestinians, some of them even calling using nuclear. Yet Israel been denying having a nuclear for nearly 50 years. Now some of them calling that they use a nuclear in Gaza.
Sure, you know? Sure, indeed. Let's look at the attention that people have given to this cause, Patrick Hennington, when it comes to Palestine in the form of the protests that have taken place. And in particular, the U.S. has really had people come out in droves and masses. A couple of weeks ago, I believe it was in Washington, D.C., where they marched towards the White House, and I'm sure you're well aware of that. I was quite surprised and then at the same time shocked to hear that an Israeli organization was offering $250, and it called it micro-grants to pay college students to attend a D.C. rally that was supposed to happen on November 14th. I don't know how that went down or not. But when you take a look at the protests in the U.S. in the way, form and manner that it is, does the U.S. administration see what has occurred? And these are not just people coming out saying, surface slogans. We're talking deep slogans here. We're talking their awareness, their knowledge about the Palestinian cause and the conflict itself. And I'm thinking it's because of the fact that they have seen so many wars happen. But this masses to come out, will that rattle the cage of officials in the White House, in particular the man at the top, Joe Biden?
Well, probably Joe Biden's completely insulated from any reports of any significant numbers, even in Washington, D.C. He's probably being briefed. They're careful not to let him know about certain things that are happening. So he'll be generally oblivious to all of this, I would think. He's not the type of person who's very canny, who'll be very interested in details and what's going on in real terms anyway, politically in the U.S. But they've really been caught by surprise. A lot of people underestimated the level of public support for the Palestinian cause. They tried very hard in the media to frame it as pro-Hamas demonstrations or anti-Semitic demonstrations, but of course it's none of that. The pro-Palestinian movement, the cause, predates woke, anti-woke. It predates all these administrations. We're going back 50 years. It's always been about liberation. It's always been an anti-apartheid issue right along South Africa for decades. So now you're seeing the numbers grow each week on week, more people coming out on the streets. And I think what you see is that, you know, while there's a degree of astroturfing, you know, by some groups that are seen to capitalize off this movement, everybody agrees, no matter who they are, that this is about right and wrong. This is about human rights. This is about preserving lives. It's about opposing genocide, ethnic cleansing, and war crimes. And a lot of people from different stripes can come together and agree on those basic human principles. That's why you're seeing the numbers you're seeing on the street. And there's a big difference between those people, which are growing and showing themselves by the millions globally, and government and mainstream media, which are defending the very narrow Israeli party line on this, which is really having trouble. It's a house of cards, really. It's having trouble legitimizing itself in the face of what are effectively open war crimes by the Netanyahu regime and the state of Israel. And they're seeing that this systematic oppression has been occurring for 75 years. 80 years, and they're realizing this just didn't happen or start on October 7th. Young people get it. Unfortunately, a lot of older people, especially in media and government, unfortunately don't get it. So that's why you have this massive disconnect. It's only going to grow.
John Phoenix, the Israeli foreign minister, just a day ago said that he expects the international pressure on Israel to rise significantly within 2 to 3 weeks. Now, my question obviously comes out, why would he think there hasn't been a rise that's significant enough? He must have seen the protests happening worldwide. But that kind of gives maybe an idea as to how long this war would last, do you think? the fact that he has made that kind of a statement?
I believe what the what just Patrick described, the thousands of people in the streets. I mean, I just seen a video of Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, being in a restaurant, and he was kicked out of the restaurant by people chanting ceasefire now. I think the European leaders now feeling the heat that the staying silence is a crime itself, you know. So I believe there is some kind of connection or some kind of communication between the Americans and the European leaders. Enough is enough, because the world cannot bear to see all this slaughter with children and women. I mean, if you look at the first week when Hamas attacked the settlers, they was crying wolf that, look, they kidnapped children, women, they attack people, which is most of the people who got killed that day was killed by Israeli helicopters. But they got, at that time, sympathy for nearly 10 days, you know. But the minute they retaliated with this barbaric scale of retaliation, now they're losing the plot. They were thinking that people now, with the thousands of civilians killed, they're not really gonna, obviously, stay silent. Talking about the accusation of being anti-Semite if you support the Palestinians, well, there is also, not to forget, there's hundreds of American Jews from Jewish Voice for Peace was actually demonstrating in Washington against the slaughter of the Palestinians. So I think there is a pressure on them. I think that will ask that soon with the economic factor, because also they're having difficulties, no schools, no jobs, no factories, you know, in the country. They nearly 200,000 settlers moved out of the border of Gaza, being hosted somewhere else, fed, looked after. The same thing with the north of Palestine, sure, border of Lebanon. There is also nearly 180,000 settlers.
Yeah,
so that's going to be a strong factor for them to stop their mini Holocaust in Gaza.
Yeah, indeed. And let's go with that. And Patrick, you know, when you have any hopes of this war ending, which hopefully at some point it's going to end sooner than later, Israel has to then go back to the reality, not go back, but face the reality that's unfolding there in the occupied territories. We know how things were before this war broke out. Things were tense on so many different fronts regarding, you know, those protests that were happening, the judicial ones. Now you have the elevated tensions between the Palestinians and the Israelis, especially the settlers. So it has to face that. And that's another war in itself, really, taking a look at what's happening there on the streets, along with the cost that is $250 million a day, I think Israel is facing. Yes. Do you think Israel is going to be able to come out of this? In 1 minute, please.
Well, yeah, economically, they've got huge problems, not just the cost of the war, but also lost income, which is going to affect their GDP. They're already having to go to the international money markets to raise funds, bonds, and domestically issuing bonds to try to raise money. The central bank is having to, $30 billion to stabilize the shekel, which is very unstable at the moment. So it's having a bad effect on the Israeli economy, but also people leaving the country as well, who, you know, obviously can just go to Florida or New York or wherever they're from and just kind of flee the trouble when things get a little bit warm. Northern Israel is also, many of the settlements, towns are empty. They've been completely evacuated. There's only active service reservists and maybe elderly left there. So,
all right, thank you very much for that. Thank you, Patrick Henningsen, geopolitical analyst from Los Angeles. And thank you, John Phoenix, journalist and international relations expert from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kavitawi and the team, it's goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran,
You're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
Researchers have found that young people who entered Britain's labour market amid the 2008 financial crisis are still scarred by its impact on their employment and earnings potential. We take a look at the World Press and Media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. New research shows millennials in the United Kingdom are still bearing the economic scars of the 2008 financial crisis and are struggling to catch up with the living standards of older groups, while US officials claim their American counterparts have closed the gap. In its annual intergenerational audit, the Resolution Foundation compares the fortunes of millennials born between 1981 and 2000 with their predecessors, including Generation X, born between 1966 and 1980. It found that after the 2008 financial crisis and the ensuing recession, the long-running pattern that had seen young people earn more on average than their parents at the same stage of life had been broken. The report said millennials born in the late 1980s earned on average 8% less at age 30 than their counterparts when the Generation X cohort, when they were at the same age. In the United States, by contrast, officials claim while the crisis also made a significant dent in millennials' earning power, recent income gains by younger workers have now helped them to catch up. Sophie Hale, the think tank's principal economist, said, "Young people across advanced economies were hit by the financial crisis of 2008, putting a stop to decades of progress. 15 years on, this crisis cohort are no longer young. And while other countries' millennials have bounced back, their counterparts in Britain are still wearing economic scars as they approach middle age. US millennials in their early 30s in 2021 were earning 21% more in real terms than people in the same age group were in 2007. However, in Britain, incomes were still 1% lower for this group than for the 30 to 34-year-olds 15 years earlier. Explaining the divergence, the report's authors pointed to long-term wage stagnation in the United Kingdom, which has been particularly bad for young graduates due to Britain's economy's inability to create enough skilled jobs. They wrote, "The typical weekly pay of university graduates aged between 30 and 34 has fallen by 16% between 2007 and 2023, while the typical weekly pay of non-graduates is down by only 6%. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. Sky-high housing costs in Britain have also meant many millennials have struggled to afford their own home at the same age as their parents or grandparents. The Resolution Foundation found that there had been some catch-up in recent years, but the millennials still remain a long way behind. The report said, around the turn of the millennium, 67% of households aged 30 to 34 were homeowners. But by 2021, this figure was still 20 percentage points lower at 47%. However, US officials claim in their country, homeownership rates have fallen by much less. 56% of 30 to 34-year-olds owned their home 2 decades ago, and in 2021, it was 50%. Sophie Hale, a British economist, said the low home ownership rates in Britain meant that many millennials were forced to live in high-cost and often low-security private rented accommodation that further impedes their living standards. Darren Jones, Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury, said, "This report paints a stark picture of an economy that no longer works for working people," adding, 13 years of the Conservatives have left an entire generation falling behind their international counterparts and no better off than their parents' generation. Ben Twomey, Chief Executive of the campaign group Generation Rent, said the last 10 years had been a lost decade for housing in Britain. Ben Twomey added, "Policies like Help to Buy have only helped existing homeowners by increasing house prices. Most young adults continue to shell out excessive rents that make it harder to save for the future, while those lucky enough to have bought could only do so by taking on large debts and are now facing crushing increases in mortgage payments." Ben Twomey added, "At least now there is action to make life better for renters through the Renters Reform Bill, but it needs to go further to give those of us locked out of home ownership the chance of a long-term home. The tough economic conditions endured by millennials may help to explain the fact that they appear not to have followed their forebearers in moving to the political right as they have aged. A recent YouGov opinion poll suggested that just 12% of 25 to 49-year-olds intend to vote Conservative at the next general election. The Centre for Policy Studies, a right-wing think tank, has published a new collection of essays titled Justice for the Young, that call for policies to help close the generation gap, including cheaper childcare and reform of student loans. Its director, Robert Colville, said, "The divide between the young and the old is becoming Britain's defining characteristic, not just politically, but economically as well." The website of CNBC has also covered the same story and tells us more. Researchers found young people who entered Britain's labour market amid the 2008 financial crisis are still scarred by its impact on their employment and earnings potential. According to a new report, the so-called crisis cohort who entered the world of work following the financial meltdown of 2008 have continued to face higher unemployment, lower pay and worse job prospects more than a decade later. Published recently by the British think tank, the Resolution Foundation, the study says that while Britain avoided a repeat of the mass youth unemployment seen in the 1980s, the impact of the financial crisis in 2008 was spread more evenly across young people, mostly in the form of a prolonged squeeze on pay. Low-skilled workers who left education during 2008 and 2011 were 30% less likely to find employment than before the downturn. And researchers said the effect lasted for almost a decade. However, the report noted that the lowest paid were afforded some protection by the minimum wage. Meanwhile, graduates who entered Britain's labour market during the same period were a third more likely to be in low-paid work up to 7 years on from the downturn. According to the report, this group of graduates were paid 6% less than graduates who entered the workforce before the downturn, with their wages taking up to 7 years to recover. According to the report, this matters because time spent in low-paying occupations reduces someone's future earnings prospects, not just because pay progression is weaker in these occupations, but also because moving to higher-paying occupations is relatively rare and pay effects do not immediately unwind when and if someone does. The Resolution Foundation urged policymakers to focus on the lasting effects of the financial crisis on young people's prospects, adding that Britain's lawmakers should be preparing for the next economic downturn. Stephen Clark, senior economic analyst at Resolution Foundation think tank, said in a recent press release that people who entered the world of work amid the financial crisis were still facing significant scarring effects. He added, "Low-skilled workers faced a higher risk of unemployment, While university graduates were more likely to trade down the types of jobs they did, with their pay and prospects stunted as a result. Stephen Clark added, these scarring effects have stayed with the crisis cohort for up to a decade, reducing their living standards at a time when they may be facing the additional financial strains of buying a home or bringing up young children.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames. And nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not. Spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night. While the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. But through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Tonight, a blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Your headlines: Israel continues its genocidal war on Gaza for the 42nd day, intensifying strikes on the territory's hospitals and people sheltering there. The UN warns that civilians in Gaza face starvation because food and water have become practically non-existent due to Israel's siege of the territory. And the American Civil Liberties Union sues Florida's university